Morning, members. We do have a quorum. Representative Eklund, you want to move the minutes from April 14th? No, he doesn't. Okay. Representative Heinzman. Representative Heinzman. You want to move the minutes of April 14th?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, thank you. The minutes are before us for April 14th.
He was reading them.
I know he was. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. The minutes are adopted from April 14th. Thank you, Representative Eklund. I didn't mean to interrupt you. You were in a conversation with Representative Purcell. Excuse me. Members, today we're having an informational hearing. There's a number of things going on with both aquatic invasive species and terrestrial invasive species, and we have in a bipartisan way over the last number of years have funded significantly and much to the University of Minnesota and some to our own DNR too for control of both aquatics and terrestrial invasives. So we thought it would be a good idea to have them come forward. And it looks like Ms. Pierce, first we're going to hear from the DNR and get an update on where we're at, specifically some significant amount of money from Lassard Sams went to DNR a few years back for potential carp control. And maybe you can give us an update. Any questions? That's the plan. We have, it looks like we have Minnesota DNR. Then we have the Terrestrial Plant Center with a couple testifiers. And then we'll do last aquatic invasive species. And as always, there'll be time for any public testimony on any of that. Welcome, Ms. Pierce, if you could identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Chair and members. I am Ann Pierce. I am Section Manager with the Division of Ecological and Water Resources with the Minnesota DNR. And thank you for inviting us to update you on where we're at. I think what I will do is talk a little bit about where our budget is right now for this last biennium, so 16 and 17. And then I can talk specifically about the LSOHC money and where that, what that was given for and where that has been used. So I, you should have a handout within your packet that looks like this. And just to give you a sense of where our budget is right now, we, the bulk of our funds come from the invasive species account, which is money that is brought in from a surcharge on boat licenses and a surcharge on out-of-state fishing licenses. And then some of the bulk of the money comes in through that, and then there is some money that comes in from various fines might come into that, different types of fines. But also we get a bit of about $750,000 from the water rec account that's transferred into that. So that is one source of our money. The other source that supports the program is the general fund. And that supports both of those accounts. The money goes to both enforcement to help with aquatic invasive species and to the program to implement regional work and the work that we do. Currently, the annual expenditures from what's coming into the invasive species account are exceeding the amount of revenues that are coming into the account. So we're pulling more money out of that account than what's coming in. If you look at the chart that you were is part of this handout, you'll see that the blue line is total resources available. And total resources available at points in time, we have had some money put into that account. So I think in 2013, we had some money put into that account from the water rec account, more than the 750. But that is the total resources available. The yellow line is the amount of expenditures that we're spending per year for both the programmatic work that we're doing and the work with enforcement. And if you look at the red line, that is the balance. So that's the balance that's being carried over from year to year. And as you can see, the balance being carried over is going down and will be into the negative 2019 is when it'll go into the negative. We have done some work where we've tried to put back some money into that account. Another source of our money is the general fund. And if you look at the next section on this handout, it talks a little bit about the county aid work. So we are given approximately $4.6 million from the general fund for both enforcement and for the program. And in 2015, when the county aid money was distributed to passed and distributed to the counties through the Department of Revenue, we were given a one-time source of funding of about $400,000 to help the counties with that work. So some of the things that the department needs to do for the counties, if the counties decide as part of their program they want to get authorized inspectors, we are required within statute to train those inspectors because they're given our authorization. So we have to do the training. We had an increase in inspectors, which is wonderful, of from about 400 to 800. So we doubled the number of inspectors out on the ground, which is a great thing with that money, but that also increased the amount of trainings we had to provide. And then we have a lot of work going on with people helping the counties figure out what resources are available, how to develop a plan, what kind of work they can do, getting coordination, having them work together, figure out what's worked for one county, what were some stumbling blocks, just bringing them along and helping them implement a program with that the resources that they're getting. The $400,000 was one-time money, and we did not get that in 16 and 17. And as you can see on the back side of this, where there's a little bit more detail, 16 and 17, the $400,000 was not in there. So at that time, we ended up trying to shift our budget around a little bit within the program and had to shift resources to other areas where it was still needed. We worked with the Aquatic Invasive Species Advisory Group, which is a group of stakeholders that advise the DNR on how to implement our program, and came up with the cuts that you see in the third bullet to the program, which is to reduce some grants that we were giving out to local units of government. One was for inspectors, and since a lot of them were spending the money on the inspectors, we reduced that. Another one was for public awareness, which is we provide templates for people to use for billboards. They can do public service announcements, a variety of different things that we can help them with and help them pay for that. So that one was cut. And then we did end up reducing the aquatic plant, the invasive aquatic plant management grants by a little over $400,000 to down to $200,000 on that to help address some of those needs. So that's where we're sitting right now with our main base budget. If you would like me to, I can talk more about the LSOHC funding, but if you have any questions on this, maybe I could answer those now and then dive into the...
Thank you, Ms. Pierce. Why don't we do this part first, Representative Fabian?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Pierce, I'm curious on the spreadsheet that you gave us for that. I'd like to know, there's a column for enforcement, and a line for inspection and field operations and affirmation. Walk me through what each of these different things entail. Ms. Pierce.
Thank you, Chair, members. The enforcement is our conservation officers. It goes for them to enforce the aquatic invasive species laws. So typically what they do things like roadside checks. They go drive around and go to accesses and see if they have violators. They might do some work with permittees, making sure that permittees are permitted and have the right requirements on that they're following the permit. They also are the first line of response for those access inspectors that you see at the access themselves. They are authorized inspectors, but of course they're not peace officers, so if there is a violation, those access inspectors can contact enforcement, and then enforcement will enforce the statute. So that's the enforcement piece. They also are, one of the new programs that we're working with them on is the zebra mussel sniffing dogs. So one way to increase our efficiency is with these dogs. So at check stations on the side of the road, they can have a dog inspect the boat, which is much quicker than people inspecting the boat and get people through faster than we had before. So that's another piece of that. The inspection program is that. It's the for the Department of Natural Resources. It is the approximately about 130 inspectors out on the ground at the access sites. We have level one inspectors, and we have level two inspectors, which are people that can do the decontamination with those decontamination machines, hot pressure, high pressure hot water machines. And so that, both the inspection program and the inspection equipment, are those inspectors and the supervisors who help manage their schedules and work with the other local units of government that have inspectors, so we're coordinating our work and not ending up at the same access at the same time. The LGU grants, those are ones I talked about, so we would give grants to local units of government to help them implement inspections and hire some inspectors. The AIS management grants are the invasive aquatic plant management grants, which are really just grants to either lake associations, sometimes local units of government, to treat invasive aquatic plants. Field operations are our staff that are out in the region, so when we have a report of an infestation of whatever invasive species it is, those are the, you know, the frontline people who go out and do the surveys and try to figure out where it is. When we had the starry stonewort and coronis, we had a number of people from our field operations go out and survey the lake, try to identify the plant, do a variety of things. They also do the management grant permits for the invasive aquatic plants, and they do a variety of other things that are out on the ground in the field. The statewide coordination are the leads for the various programs, so we have people that are coordinating our efforts for the inspection program, making sure we have consistency around the state, that we're updating, being aware of what some of the new issues might be, what some risks that we weren't aware about, and incorporating all that into our plans. We have a plant management coordinator who helps coordinate our efforts with the invasive aquatic plant management stuff. We have somebody who oversees the lake service provider permits, so they train and they oversee that whole permitting program, and then we have the supervisor of the program in that statewide coordination. There's a couple other coordinators. We have a risk assessment coordinator, prevention coordinator, and we also have a terrestrial person that isn't part of this aquatic stuff. It isn't a part of this budget that you see here. And then the next piece on the list, you'll see the invasive carp coordinator, and that is Nick Fraunauer, and he is coordinating for the Department of Natural Resources our work on invasive carp. He's helping plan, make sure that we're implementing things that we have agreed to implement, working with experts around the country on invasive carp issues. In 2015, you see that there was some insurance liability for a deterrent barrier. That was for Lock and Dam 1, and that gets back to the LSOHC money that I'll talk about later, but that did not go in, so that's blank. Lake service provider training, we give a number of lake service provider trainings around the state in the spring, and that is for people who, for hire, put equipment in and out of lakes. So it might be somebody who stores people's boats over the winter. They take the boat in and out for hire. They might be people that put docks in for hire. It might be someone who basically does some sort of building within that aquatic water body. So they get trained on how to reduce the risk of AIS spread. And then we had another section which was also cut from the FY16-17 budget, which was to implement VMPs at water accesses. So our Division of Parks and Trails oversees our water accesses. They did a number of upgrades so that it was very clear what people needed to do when they came into an access before they launched. So they had a variety of areas where it said, this is where you clean, this is where you pull over, this is where you will be inspected, a variety of things at the water accesses, and that was BMPs.
Any follow-up, Representative Babian?
Thank you. Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you. you talked about the inspectors, and the number went from 400 to 800. How do you account for those people in,
Mr. Pierce,
in your sheet?
Thank you, Chair. So the going from 400 to 800, the Department of Natural Resources hires about 130. All of the other ones are local unit of government inspectors that are authorized by the Department of Natural Resources. So when the county aid money was...
That's good enough, Ms. Pierce. Yeah. You can just answer the question. Thank you. Representative Fabian.
No, that's good. Thank you.
Okay. Ms. Pierce, I have a couple of questions. The small grants program you noted were cut, the $150,000 to local units of government. Has some of that arguably been, was that money originally before the $20 million county grants? And so it would make sense that the local units of government now are getting significant money from other sources? Or when did that start?
Chairman, members, yes. So that was before the county money came out.
Okay, thank you. And the $75,000 public awareness grants, was that before the county money also? Thank you. And then if I may ask, is the line item aquatic invasive plant management program that got cut by the $475,000, is that how you backfilled the four positions? Is that the money you used to fill those positions?
So, Chair, that $400,000 of that was, yes.
Okay. And then the $150,000, where did that money originally come from that Parks and Trails used? And it was that arguably some one-time money for signage and stuff, and that's not needed anymore? I'm just trying to get the relevance.
Chairman, that was money that
relevant.
Was for
thank
their
you.
Program to implement it. They've got it implemented. They don't
okay.
need it.
Thank you. Okay, well, I was just understanding it. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to, I think this is the right time to ask about this. The grants to local governments, that which then go to lake associations and various groups in the counties, those are really popular where I'm at. You know, there's good citizen involvement and local solutions to local challenges. I recall that the funding changed over the last several years, and I would really appreciate an update on that, whether that be from you, Ms. Pierce, or Mr. Hagemeyer. I don't know who the best person to ask, but I'd like to a review of those changes, and also I'd like to understand where those funds are now and then what we're looking at moving forward.
Ms. Pierce, just Representative Johnson, that's what I was talking about. The DNR cut those grants by $475,000 to backfill those four positions that were originally funded with one-time money in the tax bill. And when there wasn't a tax bill last year, DNR wanted to keep those four people, so they cut the grants to the local, which were used for aquatic invasive plant management. And I think all of us statewide have heard from those people. And so that was my question, exactly how much did get cut? They rounded up to 475. It was 400 originally, but it's those four positions that they used that money for. And what I did want to ask, related to yours, is do you have those applications in place where you could have spent more money if you had the 400? That would be, I think, to Representative Johnson's question of what's happening at the local level. You only awarded 200. Did you have significantly more grants, and is that for this coming season? that we're talking about?
Chair, members, typically what we do is we give them a cost per acre. So what happened was the cost per acre went down. So we can provide you with, now I think it's around $100 per acre, and last year it was probably around $300 per acre. So we have quite a few grants that were requested. We're just giving each grantee less money than they had gotten before. There probably are some people who didn't apply this year because they thought they weren't going to get enough money, but we still have a number of grant people who applied for grants and are getting some money. They're just getting quite a bit less than they did.
And Representative Johnson, sorry to kind of bust in there, but I have the same thoughts you have. Representative Johnson.
Yeah, I think my question is more broad. My question is, actually, I'm just trying to spark my memory, that originally these grants were going directly to the counties, and the counties had really a lot of control over them, and then some changes were made. I want to be reminded what those changes were, and I believe this was about 2 years ago. And then, maybe I'm not remembering this correctly, but and then I'm really curious, most importantly, what's the future look like? What do the local lake associations, what does the local efforts, these citizens-based efforts, what do they look like? What can they look forward to over the next couple of years?
Well, Representative Johnson, the $20 million is ongoing. That was in the base, and so even though there was no tax bill, the $20 million still got funded. And that goes direct to the county. The DNR's, are you the agent? Now we changed who the agent was. Or is it still Department of Revenue, whoever
still
it is? MMB or somebody handles it. They won't even let DNR touch the money. It goes right out to the county.
Okay.
But there's four coordinators at DNR that were funded originally in that one-time, funded one-time money, and those people are who they took these local grants that we're hearing from our lake associations that got cut, or they didn't get any, or they got cut from $300 to $100, and that's the $475, and that's why I was curious. So, Ms. Pierce, if you had this $475 back when the legislature leaves, whenever we actually do leave, May 23, you would have a way to get this money out the door yet this summer for these grants for people, because you're currently just giving them $100 an acre, and if you sent an update to them that they were now going to get $300, and you had, would you be able to get the money out the door this summer?
Chairman, members, we would be able to get a big bulk of it out, but there's, this gets into biology, but curly leaf pondweed, it's pretty much done by the end of June. So depending on when we got it, the curly leaf pondweed applications would probably be done by then. So, but Eurasian water milfoil would still be active.
Okay, thank you. Representative Johnson.
Yeah, and then just to clarify, moving forward, counties can expect over the next couple of years to have the same support, and the local associations can expect a similar level of funding that they've had over the last couple of years?
Well, they didn't get the 400 because it got cut for the
first. I understand that part, but in general?
Ms. Pierce.
Chairman, members, as with this budget that you see the last box, they would have that same amount of support without the $400,000. So it's $200,000 for aquatic invasive plant management.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Ugin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Pierce, I have a question about the equipment, the high pressure hot water equipment. How does that work when you send out grants to counties and things? Are the counties buying this through the DNR or through approved vendors, or who's buying the equipment?
Ms. Pierce.
Chair, members, the counties can buy it through our approved vendors. If they are buying it through our contract, then they get our contract price.
Representative Ugel.
Thank you. Follow-up. Obviously, this equipment lasts a while, and two questions. What's the expected life of this equipment, and how does that affect your budgets for this? In other words, with the grants and if the counties are buying the equipment, it lasts for 5 or 10 years. In other words, can we devote some more money towards inspectors and things like that?
Ms. Pierce.
Chair, members, the life expectancy of this equipment is fairly long. You just need to maintain it. Mm-hmm. So it would be long, and then they could spend other money on the savings from buying it one time on inspectors.
Representative Uglem. Okay. Representative, you're done? Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Excuse me. I had a couple questions on the invasive carp expenditures here.
Can we, are we done on, we can move into carp? Your questions on carp?
Yes, sir.
And we haven't got to carp yet. Ms. Pierce, did you want to talk or do you want to hear Representative Fisher's questions or he'll be the first one? Because you haven't done your carp thing yet.
I haven't done.
Oh, okay.
Well, okay, then why don't you do your carp thing and then Representative Fisher will ask his question.
Thank you, Chair and members. So, the LSOHC provided funding for the Lock and Dam 1 barrier when the state was talking about building a barrier at Lock and Dam 1.
Ms. Pierce, we've got a long agenda,
okay.
So you can just give it short and sweet. We want to know where the money's at, and then Representative Fisher will ask this question.
That didn't go. We are spending that money on other preventative measures within Minnesota River and St. Croix and looking at a feasibility study for Lock and Dam 5. The money here you see is to support the staff person who is doing all that work on there.
So how much money's left in the LHOA?
There's about $900,000 left.
Pardon me?
About $900,000 left.
$900,000. Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the question comes back on the barrier liability insurance that ended up being purchased even though we weren't going to do the, ended up not doing the project up there at Lock and Dam 1.
Chair and members, that did not end up getting purchased. That was, these tables represent budgets from the beginning of the year.
Okay.
So that actually did not get purchased.
Representative Fisher.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't know where it's more appropriate what, at this part or later in the meeting, is I'm kind of curious as I was hearing reference to Lock and Dam 5, the efforts that are going down there, what some of the research may be, because that's where we can, if I understand correctly where we are in the system, is that could help prevent the spread of the Asian carp into the Minnesota and the St. Croix river systems, if I understand correctly, if a system was developed down there, correct?
And I think, Representative Fisher, that'll probably be best if we hear from the university. That's okay. Part of the university work. So I think we'll hear from them on that.
Right.
Ms. Pierce has pretty well answered or gotten at most of what she was supposed to do. But Representative Hansen has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this goes back to the money and the budget. And the $5 AIS surcharge is over a three-year. Do you have available, and maybe you could get to the committee later, what a $5 increase would do and how that would, over a three-year cycle of cycling through the three-year licenses, what revenue that would bring in if we're continually running short here for whatever variety of reasons, that would be helpful just to see what the numbers are, unless you have them off the top of your head.
Chair and members, I don't have the exact number, but I can get that to the committee.
Thank you. That sounds good,
Mr. Chair.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Pierce, just one more question on the inspectors. You said that they're hired by the DNR. Are they part-time, full-time? Walk me through their role within the agency.
Ms. Pierce.
Chair and members, so the ones hired by the DNR are the level ones are all interns. The level twos are all permanent seasonal employees. So there's two levels. The counties hire them in various different ways.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So can you define for me seasonal, please?
Ms. Pierce.
Chair, members, seasonal would be less than 6 months, so it depends on the season that they're working. It could be a four-month. It could be a six-month. It's less than a year, basically.
Ms. Pierce, could you get back to us just with the ones I'm thinking of? Generally, they're college students, and I think they're only a lot of them work just only the three-month window, but maybe you could get back to those level ones and twos, what number of hours they work in a season. That might be good to know, just if you could send that background information of the number that the DNR hire. You don't have to get into the county people. I know that's outside your realm. Representative Fabian, is that
thank you, Mr.
Chair, what
you're
looking for?
That was it, and then I'm just wondering if any of them are volunteers, not paid.
The lake associations use volunteers at the land, right, Ms. Pierce?
Chair and members, we have about 400 volunteers that we do that go through some form of training and are DNR volunteers.
So those are DNR volunteers.
Mm-hmm.
And there's lake association volunteers too, because at the public landing on our lake, we could have a DNR person there, you can have the county people there, or you can have volunteers there, Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So could these volunteers then maybe groom cross-country ski trails in the wintertime too? And how do they avoid liability?
Representative Fabian, they probably are already doing all that. We're done, Ms. Pierce. Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's see. We've got next. Anybody else for Ms. Pierce? All right. Representative Cornish.
Just one kind of statement. When we look at the blank for enforcement there and the money spent, they didn't look for that duty. And over the years, we've given enforcement a number of duties in the last 20 years where we haven't funded them. So I'm glad to see that we do on this extra duty. I'm sure that we'd be glad to get rid of it if it put it all on county or local officials and not have them do any of it. I'm sure they're not excited about getting under boats and inspect them, but they did it because we passed the law. I just want to make it sure that they weren't out looking for money, but we gave it to them to enforce it, which is a good deal to me.
All right, thank you. Let's see, we are welcome. Mr. Vanette?
Yes.
We don't pronounce the E on the end. Mr. Vanette and Ms. Coop, if you could identify yourself for the record and give us your testimony. I think we've allowed as much as potentially a half hour for you, so that'd be great. Good to see both of you back here, and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Dr. Rob Vanette. I'm the director of the Minnesota Invasive Terrestrial Plants and Pest Center.
And I'm Heather Coop, the associate director for the Minnesota Invasive Terrestrial Plants and Pest Center.
Go ahead.
No, and we're here today to provide an update about developments in our relatively new center at the University of Minnesota. As many of you will recall, we were established to study this growing problem of terrestrial invasive species, something different from our earlier conversation this morning, but all of those non-native species that are problematic to our lands. And the university is very excited to have embarked on a very applied program of research that involves our partners so that we can develop very innovative approaches that are readily implementable in the field to change how we are thinking about and managing invasive species within the state. And it looks like we're having a slight technical difficulty. So Heather, maybe you can take things while I'm...
Sure. I just want to remind the committee that the what we call the MIT PVC, because otherwise the title is just way too long and takes up way too much time. So I'll be referring to the center as either that or MIT PVC. Its purpose is set in Minnesota laws to research and develop effective measures to prevent and minimize the threats posed by terrestrial invasive species to both natural and agricultural resources. And this is something that's really important that we would like the committee and all of Minnesotans to be aware of, is that the center's purpose is really to look at invasive species that cross over both to agricultural resources as well as natural resources. And one of the things we're finding very quickly is that they're not necessarily unique or separate, that there's a lot of crossover. So we're really looking at invasives holistically as best we can through the research that's undertaken. We will fulfill the mission, as laid out, by producing new technologies and techniques. So as a research university, we're looking at new and innovative ways to tackle these problems. We're looking for deliverable solutions that are practicable and the science that is applied. And furthermore, we feel very strongly that as part of our mission as a research university is to educate the next generation of research scientists. So there's a heavy emphasis on the recruitment and training of graduate students and postdoctoral students in the projects that are funded. Why the University of Minnesota? I would like to think that is an obvious answer to that. But one of the things I think that I've found when I've come to the university is just how incredibly talented the faculty and staff are. One of the first tasks that I undertook when I came to the university was to look at what the capacity for the kind of research to be undertaken. And what I found is that there are at least 80 faculty who have significant expertise in the field of invasion biology. And with that critical mass, it falls across all sorts of disciplines and between colleges. We have the capacity to really do a really incredibly coordinated and, again, holistic research effort to tackle the kinds of problems that we are encountering. The university also is advantaged in that it has 10 very 10 research and outreach centers throughout the state of Minnesota, and this allows the faculty both at the university and around the state to do scaling and modeling that otherwise would not be available. We also believe that the university is well suited to this task because of its emphasis on partnerships and collaborations. So we're not only working between disciplines and between colleges, but with organizations outside of the university, non-governmental organizations, local units of government, tribal governments, as well as industry. We bring value to the issue of invasion biology by setting common priorities so that our dollars can have the biggest impact. Again, we coordinate in a multidisciplinary manner. We foster the graduate student and graduate student education. We keep emphasis on the products that are useful to partners. So while there is a great need for basic research in this field, our purpose is really to look at the applied research and how that can be brought into the field as soon as possible. We also believe and have a structured response to be flexible as well as preventative. The multidisciplinary response that the university is utilizing in this effort is based upon, that's the next slide,
sure.
The prediction and prevention. So you'll see a number of programs that are being funded and projects that are being funded that really look at how we can help to mitigate the invasives that are coming to our state by predicting and preventing when they and where they will be likely to occur. In addition, the early detection and rapid response is an important variable as well, and an effort. If you look at the chart, the first two, I'm having a really hard time talking this morning. I'm just off my deathbed. I apologize. The early detection and rapid response also is really important because we can get these invasive species identified early. The costs associated with mitigating and ameliorating that are much better. And finally, if we go to mitigation, things that we see right now with emerald ash borer, for example, is incredibly expensive. And so we hope to do most of our work towards the left-hand part of the chart and the kinds of projects that we are desiring to fund. In your packet, there is also a one-page fact sheet that describes some of the projects that have been funded to date and some of the capabilities that the university has in this regard. Just to remind the committee as well, the funding for the MIT PBC has come from both the General Fund and the Environment and Natural Resource Trust Fund. Original appropriation was $3.4 million from the General Fund. We've received subsequent appropriations through the Environment and Natural Resource Fund Trust Fund. We have approximately $3.75 million pending in this year's ENRTF bill, and that will bring us to a capacity of about $14 million currently to undertake the work that we have before us.
And so we are very appreciative of those significant investments in the university and research that we feel that needs to be done, as do our state partners. But we also realize that, as you'll notice, that those dollars were allocated over a period of time, over the course of about 3 years. And because we are talking about significant sums of money, there was a constant question about what specifically will the center be doing. And we were charged, and from the outset, to make this a very worthwhile center is to have a very targeted, focused approach. And that approach comes through what we call a prioritization process. And so Dean Brian Boer, when he was before you, talked about this idea of thinking very strategically about what are the greatest threats to the state across all systems, across our forests, our prairies, our wetlands, and in agriculture, and where is the university poised to make the greatest impact. That's a huge undertaking, and to get that answer would take quite a bit of time. And so to show proof of concept, what we did was we embarked on what we called a rapid research prioritization, still going through this general question of what are the greatest threats to the state, but what can the university do to meet the needs of our stakeholders? And so what we did was we convened a meeting of the four state agencies who are primarily responsible for management of invasive species on the ground. And so we're talking about Department of Transportation, Bowser, the Department of Natural Resources, and the Department of Agriculture. The goal of our meeting was to identify what those greatest needs were for each of those agencies so that we could actually begin to do the work that we've described. And so what we did was we brought them together, We had some brainstorming sessions, and we asked what were their greatest research needs, and we specifically gave them four sidebars to be thinking about. So first, what research would actually help the agency achieve its mission? Is there research interest that would also benefit other agencies or other groups? Would those agencies be able to provide additional support, either in-kind or financial support? And obviously, the work of their interest would need to be able to be completed at the university with our existing resources. And so here's what we came up with. These are the four broad themes that our center has decided to tackle, and these really are pillars of invasive species management very generally. So the first broad area is this idea of detection and distribution. You cannot manage an invasive species if you do not know where it is. And so this idea is to be able to find invasive species early on when they're in the landscape. And so, for example, the use of drone technology as one way to do quick land surveys is something that has been of interest. But related to that, after surveys are done, that information needs to be shared. And that's another surprising factor that I've learned as I've come into this position, is that there are many groups that are doing surveys of our lands, but they're not sharing those points. And so we don't have one comprehensive map of where all of these invasive species are. And that's a problem that our center would like to tackle. Another major component is management effectiveness. In other words, finding new tools to help us better manage these invasive species. This is all technologies. We're thinking very comprehensively here. Biocontrol is a very significant area for sustainable management of weeds. This is also a bit avant-garde in some respect. So I like to at times talk about this as our goat category. So there's an incredible amount of interest in using goats for invasive weed management, for example. You can rent goats from Amazon. They'll deliver them to your door. The problem is we have no research that shows the effectiveness of that approach. There's a lot of anecdotal evidence. There are many case studies, but the research is not there to support that. That's a need that, again, our center is very interested in looking at. And then lastly, we know that our climate is changing, and the DNR, for example, is under an operational order to be thinking about how invasive species management might be impacted by climate change. And so there's an interest in conducting research, thinking about how changes in particular winter temperature, but summer temperature as well, and precipitation, how does that affect the distribution and activity of many of the invasive weeds, pathogens, and insects that are either in the state or might show up in the state if things continue to change. So those are the broad areas. So what are the critters that we might actually begin to work on? For this initial rapid prioritization, what was clear is that our state noxious weed list was a very reasonable place to begin to work. And so here you'll see the species that are listed on the eradicate list, the control list, as well as restricted noxious weeds. All of those were considered fair game for our initial call for proposals. We also quickly acknowledged that there were two other taxa of interest. One was an insect, the brown marmorated stink bug, and an issue that is growing within the state, and that is oak wilt. And we received 8 very competitive research proposals. Those went through a very rigorous vetting process. From that, we selected 4 for initial funding for a total allocation of $1.2 million. The first project is working on brown marmorated stink bug. This is an important insect, and it's a great example of crossing over both biologically and academically. So this is an insect that has shown up in the North Atlantic region and has decimated apple production within that area. Approximately $35 million of damage was caused in 1 year alone by this insect. It also has a very nasty habit of wanting to come into people's homes to overwinter, much like our Asian ladybugs do. And so there are case studies where there are 20 to 30,000 insects showing up in one individual's home, literally being scraped out by the armful to get rid of them. So it's a nuisance insect as well as an agricultural pest. In our area, we're also concerned because it may feed on corn and soybean, so it's a major issue. It has just recently shown up in the state. We have about two focal populations, one in Wyoming, another centered in the Twin Cities. This project is looking at development of tools to better describe its phenology so that growers know when to go out and to begin to scout, and to be able to forecast how extensive this insect might become as our climate continues to change. That work is being led by Dr. Bill Hutchison in the entomology department. The next project is looking at the distribution of various weeds that either are or are not yet in the state. This work is being led by David Mahler in the College of Biological Sciences. And this project is an interesting one from a couple perspectives. So first, what we're emphasizing here is that our center is not simply focused on a single department or even a single college. We are a university-wide resource, bringing together the full power of the university as a whole to conduct world-class research. And so our ability to fund a scientist in another college really is an example of how we demonstrate that value. Dr. Mahler's work is trying to better understand how does climate shape the distribution of invasive weeds, and if climate continues to change, how will that affect the threats that are currently being dealt with in the state. And I won't go into the details of his particular project other than to say he has examples of weeds that will be problems both in forests, in our prairies, as well as in agriculture. Oak wilt, this is a very exciting project. Oak wilt has been in our state for quite some time. It's a major issue here in the metro, particularly in the Anoka Sand Plains. The reason that this rose so high on our list was because this is an invasive pathogen that is spreading within the state. It's now moving further north. It's now into Mille Lacs County, Kennebec, Benton, also into Stearns County. And the challenge is that this is a pathogen that absolutely decimates red oaks. So you can go from having a tree that's perfectly healthy, it will become infected and can be dead in the order of 8 to 12 weeks, in essence, the course of a single summer. The problem right now that most land managers have is that it's a difficult challenge to try and accurately diagnose the presence of this disease. When we rely on the symptoms, it's easily confused with drought and other insect problems. So the recommended approach is to take a sample and bring it to the lab. Well, our current lab techniques take 3 weeks to get an accurate diagnosis. And what that means for this disease is that it's well on its way to killing the tree before we've even figured out what's going on. So what we've now invested in is Dr. Abdinur Abbas, who actually is not a biologist. He's an engineer. And what he brings to this is a completely new perspective on the problem, because he's developing biosensors that can take that diagnostic time from 3 weeks down to about an hour to an hour and a half, basically making in-field diagnosis a real possibility and allowing for that opportunity for more rapid action. If Dr. Abbas's approach works the way we believe it will, it has tremendous potential for application to a whole number of other invasive pathogen issues that are incredibly difficult for us to deal with. It would be a game-changing technology. Lastly, this is one of the most frustrating, pervasive weeds that we have in the state. If I were to say that, does our state have a noxious weed, a state noxious weed, this might be a strong candidate for it. Buckthorn seems to be just about everywhere. It seems to be one of the challenges that many land managers continually have to deal with. Here, our center is taking advantage of the fact that Dr. Peter Reich in the Forest Resources Department has been studying buckthorn for some time, and his research is nearing maturity. And what he has found is that, contrary to the reputation that buckthorn has developed, it's actually a very wimpy species in forests. And it's wimpy in this sense that the way it gets a foothold and the way it becomes such a nuisance is that it is one of the first plants to put out its leaves in the spring, and it's one of the last plants to drop its leaves in the fall. And the fact that it can have those leaves on during times when other vegetation is relatively quiescent, that's how it's able to maintain its presence. And what Dr. Reich has found is that by increasing competition from native plants and increasing the competition for light in particular, that you can really do a number on buckthorn. It will not eliminate it, but it certainly can drive it to densities that are not going to be problems for most managers. So we're very excited about where this work is going to be going. So just two more slides, basically to tell you where we are currently and, more importantly, where we're going in the near future. The big prioritization, so I alluded to the fact that we needed to take this comprehensive review. We've identified a list of over 120 different taxa that are problems to both forests and agriculture, prairies, and wetlands. We've now reviewed all the biology. We've hired a team of graduate students to help with that, and we are about to go back to our scientific panel to cross-check the work of our center. That work will be summarized in a white paper that will be made available for public comment. We are also engaging in more and more conversations with land managers so that we can better appreciate the needs not just of our state agencies, but all of the private institutions, non-governmental organizations, and informal groups who want to do something about in the invasive species problem. We've also, within our center, worked more diligently to improve our presence of social media so that we can share information in a more timely manner. And we're also beginning to cultivate other sources of support for the long-term maintenance of the center. And I believe this is our next to the last slide. So our intent is that this spring we will be able to put out a second major call for proposals, at which time we'll be able to fund approximately $4 million for research. And the idea here is that we want to identify successful research projects and then have some reserve funding to continue to reward those promising avenues. We're anticipating that with our next call, we'll be able to fund 10 to 15 research projects, so that will make a major dent in our ability to manage that broad suite of species. But at the same time, in addition to those large research projects, we're also recognizing the need and value of implementing a small grants program. The idea being that we can offer some seed money to jumpstart projects, basically allowing researchers to hire just enough money to hire a student for the summer, have a little operating budget, so that that might be able to gather some preliminary data for some of those intriguing ideas that need a little more testing. So with that, I think we'll wrap up our comments, and at this point, we're open for any questions that you might have.
Representative Houseman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When you discussed oak wilt, you discussed new diagnostic technologies. Once you have the better diagnosis, is there effective treatment?
There are a number.
Dr. Burnett.
Yes. Mr. Chair, Representative Houseman, the idea is that, yes, there are a number of appropriate actions that can be taken, but it requires an accurate diagnosis of the disease. And those are twofold. So one is the use of fungicide injections. The other is a more area-wide approach where we actually break the grafts that form between oak trees and the pathogen can move through those grafts. So those two approaches have proven very effective, and that's based on years of previous research.
Any follow-up, Representative Houseman? Okay. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I was getting a visual of a drone-dropped goat there earlier when you were talking drones and goats from Amazon. So I,
Representative Hansen, we can probably drop half a dozen of them at a time with the new DNR helicopters.
Yeah, there we go. Extraction might be the problem, I think, though.
Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair, and I'd asked Ms. Taylor to go back at the and look for the establishment language for the invasive center, and I think it's a example of good law where we provide, we direct the coordination with the various entities at the university, and we also list some tasks for them to do. And it sounds with this report, and you had to provide a statutory report last year, but I think it's good that we're hearing from them. I do have a couple questions because the money was a one-time appropriation. Is it possible for the Terrestrial Invasive Center to apply for grants from the new transfer board that was established last year?
Dr. Burnett.
I have
I should say that I don't know about the transfer board, and so Heather, I don't know if you know.
Ms. Cooper, Representative Hansen, can you elaborate? Sure. Maybe would they understand what you're talking about?
Maybe if Ms. Taylor, the Ag Transfer Board that was established, or Mr. Hagemeyer.
Everybody's shaking their head, so you have to tell us, Representative Hansen.
I didn't vote for it, so it's...
How about if, Representative Johnson, you know.
Thank you. I'll give it a stab. In the last Ag bill, we transferred, I believe it was $10 million, but don't quote me on exact money. But it was designed to promulgate research that deals primarily with production agriculture. And if you look at the range of grants available, they're very wide and involve issues that are relevant to this committee, as well as obviously research that's more directly related to production agriculture.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Hansen.
And Mr. Chair, my point on this is, well, maybe this is a function of time. As we're here longer, we see different entities that are established over time, and then they operate as their own ship moving through, and where there may be cross-pollination as an opportunity. So I would hope, you know, some of the things you're talking about here with invasive pests and some of the things that were talked about when the bill was passed about weed-resistant crops or herbicide-resistant weeds in crops. Those type of things, I think, there's an opportunity for collaboration, there's an opportunity for funding to enhance each other rather than, I would hope that people aren't doing the same thing in different buildings without the collaboration. And maybe by having these hearings, that gives an opportunity to get people working together on those.
Well, thank you. Ms. Koop.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, to your point, we recently applied for a grant from the Institute of Environment to gather scientists and people from industry and natural resources and agriculture to discuss the soybean aphid issue that was raised. And we hope that grant to be successful and hold a symposium next fall on that topic. So we are looking at other funds as we go through the establishment infrastructure for the session.
Thank you. Thank you. Appreciate it. Seeing no other questions, thanks for coming forward, and thanks for the really good work. I think you're showing how this LCCMR money can be used long-range, allow the university some flexibility, and create a good process where you screen folks out and you partner with money and all that. So thank you for coming forward. Appreciate you coming.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes. Next, I think we have the Aquatic Invasive Species Center with Dr. Galitowicz and Ms. Natch. I don't know, Doctor, if you're still director. I guess it would just be professor, maybe, or doctor. I think we have a new director. Maybe you're still the director today. Welcome. Please identify yourself for the record.
Happy to. I'm Dr. Susan Galitowicz. I am director of the Minnesota Aquatic Invasive Species Research Center, and I'm also department head of fisheries, wildlife, and conservation biology at the University of Minnesota.
And what was your thing, Doc, as a college professor? What do you teach?
Wetland ecology, restoration ecology, invasive species.
Welcome, Ms. Natch. Natch, if you could identify yourself.
Hi, I'm Becca Natch. I'm the associate director of the Minnesota Aquatic Invasive Species Research Center.
Okay, why don't you go ahead. Do you have an estimated time on your presentation? Just trying to get it all right here.
You know, we're gonna try to be quick, cut it short a little bit, so there's plenty of time for questions.
You'll do
than 10, 15 minutes. Is that okay?
Yep.
Okay.
Doc, you'll do. Go ahead.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, members, we're pleased to be here today to give you an update on the center. And just as a reminder, I think many of you are familiar with MACERC, which is our acronym, which is what we do at the center is develop research-based solutions to reduce the impacts of aquatic invasive species in Minnesota, and that includes solutions to prevent spread, control populations, and manage those lake, rivers, and wetlands. The center was created to build research capacity to find AIS solutions. Unlike with terrestrial invasives, we did not have much capacity to approach this issue, and so that's been a key part of what we've been doing. We also were created to do research with that capacity that can be used to reduce those impacts. For the research that we do to be actionable, we need to collaborate, and we need to have close working relationships with lake associations, local governments, and DNR, and others addressing AIS, because those folks will be key to implementing the solutions that we find. So that's an important distinction, I think, that we're focused on research, and we need many partners to implement the discoveries that we make. So we're going to share with you today our progress on all three capacity building solutions and collaborations.
First, just a little bit of history about the research center.
Ms. Naff.
Mr. Chair and members, the Minnesota Aquatic Invasive Species Research Center was founded in 2012 with legislative appropriations of $2 million from the Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund and $1.8 million from the Clean Water Fund. Another appropriation of $8.7 million was provided by the Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund in 2013. Upon its establishment, the most significant amount of MACERC funding, in the amount of $4.4 million, was dedicated by its founder to common carp and Asian carp research. $1.6 million was dedicated by the founder to hiring a new full-time zebra mussel researcher. $1.5 million was dedicated to extension and outreach activities, and this was actually reflected in the appropriation language as well. $940,000 was dedicated to invasive plant research, and a small amount of $24,000 was appropriated or allocated to screening of viral hemorrhagic septicemia virus. In 2014, the founder sought and received $854,000 additional for research on Asian carp. And in 2016, he sought and received $880,000 additional from the Minnesota DNR, which I believe is a reallocation of outdoor heritage funds, and about $80,000 from the federal government, again, for Asian carp research.
So over time,
and under
my leadership, MACERC has kept those initial commitments while expanding research, especially in zebra mussels and invasive plant control. And so what I'll do is describe to you how those research investments have been used. And so I'll direct your attention to one of the handouts that you have with all the bar diagrams that talk about the funding that we've received, which has been one-time funding and is the way that we're funding our research projects between 2012 and 2019. And what you'll notice there is that we have received about $10 million for specific research projects. Half of that is dedicated to carp research, and the other half goes for all of the other aquatic invasive species that we study. I'll also draw your attention to the difference between those sort of totals over that time period and the annual amount of money that we have on hand to spend, because that does certainly sort of give us, you know, whatever capacity we have to solve these problems. So a few of the highlights, then I'll draw your attention to this second handout, which is a summary of our key efforts to date. And I'll walk through a few of those sort of key areas of work and progress. One of the major issues that we faced upon center establishment was the need to develop research capacity to work on zebra mussels. There simply was no one at the university and even in the state to do work on zebra mussel biology and control. We hired that person in 2014, Mike McCartney, and together with several other collaborators, he has been working on research to identify the most important mechanisms of spread and pathways, to develop new detection tools, and also to collaborate with local and state government and lake associations on developing survey protocols for some of the recent trials on Zequinox and other control measures. Recently, we've partnered with USGS to do research on improving the efficacy of some of those key control compounds, including Zequinox, EarthPEC, and so forth. And so we've expanded our research, and this area is so new for us. In other words, we're only in our second year here, that we're hopeful that we will have work that makes a difference be coming out shortly. There's much promising research that's being done. Spiny water flea is another key concern in the state of Minnesota, and that's one that was not originally scoped within the center's projects, and one where we felt there was an urgent need to pay attention to this species, especially its effects on large lakes. And so we've recently teamed with the University of Minnesota Duluth and are now launching research to try to figure out some of the get some key knowledge about detecting this species, the lag times of detection, which appear to be long now, and then also understanding the effects on lake food webs. That's crucial for really improving the fisheries models that are used on some of the large lakes like Mille Lacs. That's not the solution to the problem, but it is an important piece of information for management right now. Aquatic plants, this is one where we've greatly expanded our capacity as well, particularly with the recent hire of Dr. Dan Larkin. Our work so far here has involved looking at both biocontrols and lake treatments for water milfoil. We've had significant progress on curly leaf pondweed control measures. We've developed low dosage endothelial treatment protocols for curly leaf pondweed that we believe will minimize non-target impact on native aquatic vegetation. And so that work's been led by Dr. Ray Newman, who's been at the U for quite a while working in aquatic plant management. We also are working on improving the efficacy of controls for curly leaf pondweed as well as milfoil. We are also very involved in starry stonewort, the state's newest invasive species. Dr. Larkin started about a month after that species was discovered in the state. He's been working collaboratively with DNR and with lake associations, for instance, to develop the protocols for the management trials this summer. He also has begun work on scoping out how we'll do the herbicide treatment trials, and that'll be among the first research projects that will be launched in our new facility as it opens in the next week or two. He's convening a team of experts who've worked on starry stonewort in other states, and they're convening in Minnesota in June to try to put together a coordinated research and management response for the species, which has not been done before nationally. And so it basically rests with us to make that happen, take advantage of those lessons learned from other states, but really try to come up with a herbicide solution or a solution for control that so far is lacking. We also have been made investments. Before I move on, you can see for aquatic plants, for instance, we have about $250,000 a year that we invest in Eurasian water milfoil research, about $161,000 right now a year in curly leaf research, and about $81,000 a year in starry stonewort, much of that going to investigator salaries. We have made strategic investments, although at much lower rates, looking at harmful viruses and microbes, and at for $400,000 total and about $100,000 per year. And with those funds, we developed and implemented statewide screening for VHS, and also are currently determining the threats that Heterosporus plays to threats to game fish, again, to inform lake fisheries management and to improve disease surveillance of that species. We also have some other sort of multi-species projects, but I think in the interest of time, we'll talk about our work in fish invasive species, since that is such a large portion of the center's work.
Ms. Nash.
Great. So, the largest, most substantial portion of our portfolio is in research on Asian and common carp, a total of $5.4 million, which is over half of our entire research budget. I just want to point out to you here on your handout that many of these projects have the start date of 2012, and that is because these were the first investments made, the first people hired, and this was a full 2 years before any of the other projects at the Research Center were launched. So you hear from us a lot about Asian carp work. We have the most money going here, the most number of projects, the most number of staff time working on this project, and it's been going for the longest amount of time. You hear a lot of our, we talk a lot about our work about Asian carp, and certainly the results are coming at a much earlier rate than the rest of the project, which makes sense. Also, this first project here listed developing and implementing a sustainable control program. This is a culmination of work that began, I was just talking to Dr. Sorensen, I think the first investment from Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund came to him in 2000. So this is many, many years in the working and many millions of dollars that have already gone into this program to get to the point where in 2015 we were able to declare three lakes in the western suburbs had reached, had gotten their common carp controlled to a sustainable level where it can be manageable in the future. A lot of the early investments from 2012 went into developing better detection techniques for Asian and common carp as a surrogate to Asian carp, and also in figuring out how to attract common carp and aggregate them, or I'm sorry, Asian carp, attract and aggregate them so that they can be either poisoned or removed. I think our lab, Sorensen Lab, has been on the forefront of the eDNA work and has developed improved protocols for that technique and has determined that it is a very sensitive tool for detecting carp. However, the rates at which eDNA decay in the environment is very high, so that if you collect a water sample and get a positive detection, it is very certain that a carp was just recently there. But if you have a water sample that does not detect carp, does not mean that it wasn't there, that eDNA is degrading sometimes in as quickly as a day. And then I think for the sake of time, I'm going
to excuse me, Ms. Nash, yeah. To that point, Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Ms. Nash. So we see the reports now when fish are caught, usually by the commercial anglers. Is there coordination between your entity and, so if you're finding a detect, do commercial anglers go out in that area? I'm thinking hypothetically the St. Croix. We seem to find the fish in the literal fish in Mississippi, but are you searching the St. Croix or upstream Minnesota River, finding eDNA and then having commercial anglers go out, or is it just the commercial anglers are getting lucky in November and December when they're getting them as bycatch?
Right. Ms. Nash.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hanser, it's a very good question. It also kind of points to the difference between what we do at the research center and conducting the research and developing the tools, and also the management activities that fall to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the DNR. So we are working on advancing eDNA as a tool and a technique. However, it is the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service that takes the lead on actually doing the surveillance and doing the testing. So when they find a positive hit, and I'm not sure, I would look to the DNR to find out. I don't think that this has happened except for, I know that when the, there's only been one positive hit, I think, for the eDNA, but when the commercial fishermen, or actually the recreational fishermen, were catching the fish in St. Croix, there was a coordinated effort with DNR who then got their crews out there and did some electrofishing to determine the extent of the fish. I think it's very difficult, actually, because of the nature of those fish, to catch them. I mean, people were catching them on lines, but in terms of going out there with nets and collecting them, they are pretty wily and learn and escape from those nets.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And from what you're seeing with the research or your research team, we all think of the silver carp because that's the video,
right.
But it appears that what we as a state have been catching are the big head carp or grass carp sometimes,
right,
as well. What's, in your opinion, what's most likely to be here?
Ms. Nash.
Mr. Chair, members, I don't know if I can make a statement on that.
All right.
Next time.
Were you almost done? It sounded like we're going to begin to wrap up, and I cut you off.
I can wrap up. I can talk about the lock and dam work. That sounds like there are people interested in about that. So starting in 2012, we were able to reprogram some of our funding to get five speakers installed at Lock and Dam Number 8. The remainder of the work here on the listed on your project sheet has been focused on using acoustic deterrents and looking at the existing lock and dam systems as a way to deter Asian carp. And you may know that the lock and dams have two components to them. There's the lock chambers, and then there's the gates, the roller gates and the tainer gates. The work has been focused in the lock chamber on acoustic deterrents, and then a lot of work has been focusing through the gate system on modeling the velocity flows of the water through those gates and then comparing that with swimming swim capability testing that we've done with the Army Corps of Engineers down in Mississippi to see if we can advise the Army Corps of Engineers on how they can modify their gate operations so that the velocity flows coming through those gates exceed the swimming capabilities of the fish. And indeed, the swimming capability test did show that that Asian carp are more ordinary swimmers than we had previously thought. They're not like salmon, and so that there is great promise that there can be modifications of the gate operations. Our early results have been presented to the Army Corps of Engineers, and they have been receptive to making those modifications. Funding from the DNR was just granted $880,000 to move some of this modeling that's been done to determine the potential for this, to move that out in the field. So they're actually going to be tagging fish and looking at them at lock and dam number 2 and adjusting the velocity flows and seeing how the fish actually do behave and testing that against the model. And then when they do get that perfected, they will be able to implement it at locks 2 through 8. So it's a whole system-wide approach.
Thank you. Is that, you're done? Dr. Gladovich, anything to add?
Mr. Chair and members, I think we can move on to questions and answers in the interest of time.
Okay, thank you. You know, one comment I'd like to make to both you and to the terrestrials, I think both of these centers have served as great examples of where you got significant amount of state money, for the most part, from both LCCMR and or Lessard Sam's Outdoor Heritage, and where those commissions thought it was wise to move a large block of money to the university to do really good things. And you both have talked about how you've been innovative, have had competitive process amongst the professors, and found specifically, you mentioned, I think it was the Stony Wart one, how that popped up. You were able to put some money to that right away. I think it seriously raises the question of, should we have a process where we individually look at college professors coming forward and saying they want 200 grand to do this or 400 grand to do that, when would we be better to give those a large block of money maybe to the university? I would want to also allow the MNSCU and the private colleges to be part of a process, but I think, members, you should recognize the great work you're doing here. Specifically, I heard you talk about how you don't duplicate, you don't have competitive projects working against each other. I would remind members to look back at some of the funding in the LCCMR bill and many of the questions that were raised. It seems like there should have been coordination between these two projects. They look like they're duplicative and things like that. That wasn't my thought when I had both of you come forward, but as I've been listening to both of these presentations, I am hearing that over and over. Dr. Gladovich.
Mr. Chair and members, I think that's a very interesting idea, and we'd be happy to work with folks to develop that further. And sort of to that point, we've taken some of our administrative savings, $600,000 this year, and what we assume might be even $500,000 this next year on administrative savings, and shifted that to a competitive request process to allow for other researchers beyond those originally involved in the center or at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities to be able to really be part of the center's work in solving these problems. And so we received 17 proposals from a variety of researchers around the state. And so those collaborations, we feel, is going to be a key way that we'll be able to address, you know, more of the high priorities that the state has. And so that model could certainly be expanded, and it worked quite well.
And the other point, Dr. Gladovich, which I didn't make, but one of you or both of you made, that you have opportunities to where you grab some money and partner and collaborate with maybe some federal grant or somewhere else or whatever. That, again, is not necessarily an opportunity that presents itself when the individual proposals come to LCCMR. So I just think it's an interesting I think this is great. I mean, what you've been able to do with that large block of money Thank you.
Yes.
Did you have a comment on that?
Mr. Chair and members, leveraging the LCCMR funds and clean water funds that we have is critical, and in part was one of our selection criteria on our recent request, is we want to see people leveraging so that we get more from these funds.
Thank you, and thank you for your work, and good luck moving forward. I know you're not going to be the director in a short little while. Did anybody have any to that point? Otherwise, I'll go. I've got Uglum, Hausman, and Torque. Representative Uglum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I'd like to echo the chairman's remarks. I think you guys are doing a wonderful job and certainly appreciate it. I have two questions, one with regard to physical barriers and the other to biocontrol. But first question about the Mississippi River and the federal closure of lock and dam, I believe number one, and the expansion and rebuilding of the Coon Rapids Dam. Is it your opinion now from a physical barrier standpoint that the Mississippi River is in pretty good shape in terms of the invasive carp moving upstream to particularly the Rum River and Mille Lacs and areas like that? The physical barriers, are you satisfied with what we have?
Dr. Gladovich and Ms. Nash, you need to recognize that Representative Uglum lives upriver of both the St. Croix and the Minnesota, so his concerns are a little different than Representative Johnson's and mine. Ms. Nash.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative, good question. I don't think that the waters are safe from, and I am not a scientist, but I will tell you from the evidence that I'm seeing from our researchers, no, the Mississippi River and the state of Minnesota is not safe right now, and that's why we're continuing our efforts on these lock and dam systems. And not only on one lock and dam system, but the idea is to make a redundant system throughout up the Mississippi River, and certainly downstream of the St. Croix River and downstream of the Minnesota River. So we still, even if Coon Rapids is protected up there, there's still a great portion of the state that's vulnerable.
Correct.
Ms. Nash, I got eye movement from Representative Torkelson that remind me that he's on the Minnesota River also. That's Representative Uglum.
Second question. I see here that you've managed to discover two novel viruses that are useful for a carp biocontrol. Could you expand on that? That's fascinating.
Sure.
Dr. Gladovich or Ms. Nash?
Mr. Chair, Representative, this is work that's being done by Nick Phelps, who's one of our kind of up-and-coming researchers out of the College of Veterinary Medicine. He has been scanning carp populations. First of all, we have Asian carp that we rear in the lab, and those Asian carp get sick and die. They're clearly getting sick and dying of something, so we're trying to figure out what is that, and is that something that we could potentially move out into the field in a species-selective way as a control measure. He's also looking at common carp die-offs as well for the same reason. Actually, Asian carp die-offs have been occurring as well, so he is networking with people across the country to get access to those fish as soon as possible to screen them for possible pathogens. So he has found two novel viruses, and as soon as he can get into our new lab, he will be conducting tests both on their pathogenicity and on their species specificity. So we hopefully the idea is that they only the fish we want to get sick from them would get sick from them.
Okay, Representative Uglum.
Thank you.
Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to follow up on your questions earlier. In the first paragraph, you discuss how the center sought funding from 2012 to 2016. Who seeks funding, and how do you seek funding as a center to fund the research?
Dr. Gladovich.
Mr. Chair and members, our funding still is primarily from LCCMR and state sources, and recently we've made another request to LCCMR under the 2017 appropriation. And because many of the problems we're working on are of highest priority to Minnesota, our logical sources of funding are always going to be, you know, often centered on the state. In addition to that, though, individual researchers will be seeking federal funds as well as funds collaboratively with local governments. And so it's really at two levels. The center is seeking, core funding for research, and the ability to basically conduct research over many organisms. And individual researchers are seeking funding to further their specific projects.
Representative Hausman.
Mr. Chair, and so you mentioned they would seek local and federal, but
And state as well.
But they're, so all the researchers are empowered to seek their own funding from those sources?
Yes, yes.
Dr. Glatter.
Absolutely. It's an expectation.
Representative Hausman.
It looks like there's a second.
Ms. Nash.
Thank you. I just want to clarify that, of course, the funding that the center is applying for and receives has a process of prioritization and vetting internally. So that's also what we bring to the table when we are seeking funding, is a sort of a assurance to funders that these are the priorities that we have developed by working with state agency representatives and stakeholders, that these are the priorities that need to be funded.
And Mr. Chair,
Representative Hausman, sorry.
Just one more. So individual researchers seek their own funding. Is there an assignment of one staffer in the center who seeks the broader funding? Where does that responsibility fall in your?
Dr. Gladwich.
Mr. Chairman, members, so at the center level, it falls to the director and the associate director in collaboration with all the researchers. So basically, when we're putting together a major proposal that's crossing over many researchers, the two of us will be taking the lead and involving the researchers in developing those proposals.
Representative Hausman.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Welcome to committee. I'm curious about Lock 8. I know that I happened to have a chance to tour Lock 8 when it was dewatered a couple of winters ago, and I know that speakers were installed. What's the situation on the research in Lock 8?
Ms. Nash.
Mr. Chair, members, the speakers were installed, again, in early 2015. The idea for that was sort of an emergency stopgap measure to get those speakers in. They were the most sort of accessible, cheapest, high-amplitude speakers that we could get them in the water now, while additional research was being done for convenience sake in the auxiliary chamber of Lock and Dam number 1. So we know those speakers are there. We know they're operational. You know, we collect data on them going on and off when the doors open and close. But they have not been studied to determine if they are actually holding TARP back or not. So with this recent funding from DNR, the $880,000, some of that funding will be used to do to use side scan sonar, looking at the fish just inside and outside of the lock door to see where they are when the speakers are on and where they are when the speakers are off, to see how they are reacting to that and to gain inferences from that as to whether they're actually doing the job with the TARP. So again, in the meantime, some additional research is being done on other acoustic deterrents to see if there's something better than what we have there.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so when will that work at Lock and Dam 8 commence? Are you planning on that to do that this summer?
Yep, this summer.
Ms. Stamp.
It'll be done. It has a 2-year time frame on it. So money just in February. Should be completed in 2 years.
Thank you.
So, Ms. Nash, to that point, so you're not at this point applying for any money to LCCMR to actually implement additional controls down at Lock and Dam 8 or 5 to implement this potentially? You're going to wait until 2 more years of study on if these are working effectively?
The center has not applied for any additional funding. The Sorensen Lab has been talking about a proposal to do an implementation project at Lock and Dam 5 using an enhanced bubble curtain. That project has not been vetted through the research center, so we don't have all the full details about it. We do have a little bit of information. I'll let Dr. Gladovich address the rest.
Dr. Gladovich.
Mr. Chair and members, yes, Dr. Sorensen brought this proposal to MASRC's attention shortly before the the due date for LCCMR 2017 proposals. And so I first learned of it on March 4th in the afternoon, and we were able to set up a meeting with Dr. Sorensen on March 9th, our internal deadline at the university's March 15th. And so, you know, as he noted in the Star Tribune, it's too early to say who would own and operate the facility after it's installed. And so there's key questions that really have not really been looked at internally at the U to determine, you know, basically how the U could support that. And so it's not a matter of needing to study it in a protracted way, but there is a need for the university before we can sign and say that as an institution that this project, you know, is sound and ready to go. There's more information and more coordination that's needed with the implementation partners. So basically, what happens to this facility in the long term? What are the operational costs? What are basically the, you know, the sort of the pre-design feasibility sort of constructs on this. And see, so there's a lot of details that we need to sort of have available to figure out how to get this thing, you know, who should do it, how to do it, and hopefully that information will have an opportunity to be developed.
Well, thank you. And we have in the past, we specifically did it last year, we have allowed additional time beyond the normal LCCMR deadline. So I would ask you to work with all the people at the center and see if that makes sense at this time. Should we allow, and I don't expect you to answer that now, but just please think about the fact that we could allow additional time if this proposal makes sense. We should be more fluid in LCCMR and Lessard-Sampson here at the legislature to allow. I understand you have a protocol and a process to work through, but if something makes sense, I would hope that if you need more flexibility from us, that we'd be able to offer that. I don't know if you have a comment on that. I have two legislators that wanted to speak to this point, and then we're going to have to probably just have the questions asked, and for the most part, you may have to give us written answers because we're going to run out of time. But to that point, Dr. Gladovich.
Mr. Chair and members, also, you know, there are key partners on this, U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, Fish and Wildlife Service, and DNR. And those agencies are, you know, really need to be at the table when we figure out, you know, how to support this project, because those are the management agencies in the Upper Mississippi River. And to what extent are we moving from research to implementation? And that's going to be, you know, an important thing to figure out the most efficient way to do this. And so it goes beyond the center, and it really requires that, I think, multi-partner look at this project.
Okay. To that point, Representative Hackbarth.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, there's a number of different barriers, and we've talked about a few here today, the acoustics and bubbles, and there's lights, and there's electric barriers and things like that. And some of those I haven't heard talked about here. So I hope we're looking at all of the possibilities of fish barriers, because I understand that there's already been some research done on a lot of these different kind of barriers and their effectiveness. And not just which is the cheapest way to go, but I think the effectiveness is really the key. Which is going to work? What's the percentage of fish that are being kept out? And what's working now? I know that we're using a number of different electric fish barriers for carp right now, and they seem to be, from what I understand, 100% effective when we're talking about electric fish barriers. We've looked at this before back in, I think it was 2012, Mr. Chairman, and we see that a number of these light barriers and bubble barriers and things are not as effective as electric barriers. So I hope that we're looking at all the possibilities that will work. We had a proposal in 2012 to start this redundancy, and it didn't make it through the funding process, which is unfortunate, but we could have started this redundancy a number of years ago, and I think it was the right thing to do. So as we move forward, I don't know that I'm disheartened by not knowing exactly how these acoustics are going to work and why we haven't done more with that to figure out
how many fish are being kept out or if are any getting through. So I think this is a key, Mr. Chairman, before the legislature starts funding some of these projects to actually get more information. Things have been done in other states and other places with these other types of barriers that we're talking about right here, right now. What are those facts all about and how were they conducted? I think there's some electric barriers right now that are being very, very successfully used, and I don't know why we're not looking at those. That's just a statement more than a question, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
And thank you, Representative Hackbarth, for that. Members, I have six more members that want to speak, and I apologize to the testifiers. I'm probably actually going to ask them to ask their questions. If it's a yes-no answer, I ask you to give it back to us. Otherwise, I'm going to ask you to work through my office and get back to some replies because the members have been sitting diligently. Representative Hausman, yours was to this point. Representative Hausman. So basically, we're going to have about 1 minute for each of the six people left. Representative Hausman.
I think I'm a little more confused now because to my earlier question about who seeks funding, and I asked, are researchers empowered or does the center do it? And I thought you said it's both, the researchers are empowered. Your last answer, though, seemed to suggest that on that specific research project that didn't meet a timeline or something, sounded as though that researcher couldn't go directly to seek funding, they would need your approval. So I'm hearing two different answers in
Dr.
terms
Gladwich.
Of...
Mr. Chair, members, all researchers at the University of Minnesota must have approval for the research projects before they leave the university to assure that they, you know, basically meet the standards of Regents policy, and that includes things like having, sound, being fiscally sound, and so forth. And so basically that's part of it. Can the University of Minnesota back this project? Is it ready to go? And so those are the kinds of the uncertainties on this project that prevented the university from signing off. And so there is a process of approval at the institution so the institution can back the researcher
Thank you.
In that effort.
So Thank you.
It sounds like you might follow up on that, though.
No, go ahead, Representative.
No,
Paulson.
I mean,
yes.
You earlier.
Yeah, we'll continue to hear on that proposal. Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's very similar to this. I'll make it real short. Hearing that some of these methods are effective or not, it'd be nice to know what is the effectiveness of your research is proving right now on each of the processes to help keep out the invasive carp. And then the other part that would go with this is how far are we in the research to it? How close are we to rolling things from being research into practical applications?
Thank you. Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Looking at the handout here and on the regarding spiny water flea, you're talking about assessing the rate of food web disruption. Has that been done regarding zebra mussels?
Ms. Nass or Dr. Gladwich, if you don't know, you can get back to us on that answer. It's a good question.
Mr. Chair, members, we'll get back to you with a more comprehensive answer on that.
Thank you. Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is for either testifier, and you can get back to us on this one, too. But in the first paragraph, you've got $1.6 million to hire a new full-time zebra mussel researcher. I'm hoping that's not his salary for a year. So could you give me a breakdown as to what that $1.6 million went for and how much he does make a year?
Either one of you know close on that, or do you just want to get back to us?
We can get back to you, but that was, just so you know, it's his salary and his full research program for 6 years.
For 6 years. Do you need more information than that,
no,
Representative Green?
Fine.
No, you did fine. Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is to the testifiers, and I would really appreciate some follow-up later on by email. You had mentioned earlier that you're using viral pathogens as possible control mechanism for these invasive species. As a medical person, that's kind of a red light for me. Is this something that's new? And I would like to know if this is something that's new, or is this something you're doing independently on your own? And do other states, because you're dealing with an entire ecosystem here, if you introduce a viral pathogen to control these fish in Minnesota, sooner or later it's going to spread to other states, and other states might not like that. So I would really like to get some more information and some follow-up on how new this is and where you're at with using viruses to control these things.
Dr. Gladwich, why don't you get us a little more information, but I think it seems that would be good Some of our members have maybe never been over to the center to talk about how that's taking place in the center and how you control that, what's going on there, so it's not out in the environment. Dr. Gladowitz.
Mr. Chair, members, you know, I agree that, viruses are an especially risky form of biocontrol. We're seeking sort of all possible solutions, but you're right in, you know, sort of raising the prospect of a risk. That those viruses are nowhere close to any sort of implementable biocontrol. It's sort of part of a larger look at possible agents for CARP.
Paula and Newberger.
Yeah, briefly. So is this something you're doing independently, or are other states doing this as well?
Dr. Gladwell. Ms. Nash.
I can't speak to other states right now, but this certainly is an idea that was inspired by work that's being done in Australia.
Perfect. Thank you. Representative Hansen, you have the last word.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and if the testifiers or someone else could get back on this. I think the challenge, you know, and I appreciate the chair having this hearing. I think this hearing has actually generated more questions than there were questions, and there's some concern about what exactly is going on at the center. And I think some part of that, that's why I looked at the statute on the terrestrial. It's quite detailed, but the enabling legislation for you guys is one paragraph, and maybe it needs to be a little clearer, because I'm unsure, and I think others are unsure, of what the focus is. Is it basic research? Is it taking basic research, applied research, and getting it out in the field? Is it extension? Is it taking the information that already exists and getting it out? And what's the pie chart, or what's the priority on that? Because I think we heard in the previous testimony, you know, they've got a task that they're working on. I appreciate that you're getting additional money, but we've been, Representative Hackbarth, we've been talking about CARP for a very long time. And we've been talking about zebra mussels for a very long time. And so the purpose, I believe, for the Aquatic Invasive Center was to try to get some long-term solutions, some basic research that then could be applied and then distributed, so that we would, maybe in that order, to get help out for Minnesota. And I'm not sure if that's what's happening. I'm not sure if it's the reverse of that. I'm not sure if it's a combination of that. I'm not sure what is the priority. And I think that, Mr. Chair, is what we need some feedback on.
Well, and thank you, Representative Hansen, for those comments. And Dr. Gladowitz, thank you for coming forward. And if you want to take 15 seconds to reply, that would be fine.
Mr. Chair, members, I think that your point about our role is to do research that can be put into action to solve problems is what we're doing. It's what we said we would do in 2012, and we've maintained that commitment. We haven't shifted. We haven't drifted. It's what we do. And that is basically, you know, I hope what we could give you a sense of today.
Thank you, Ms. Nash and Dr. Gladowitz, for being here, and for both Dr. Sorensen and the Dean to be here in case there was additional questions for either of you. Members, I would like to thank, we may not be back again. I'm not aware of a need, but as you know, things can always pop up. But we've had two very able pages this year that we would like to thank at this time, both Allison and Roberta. Thank you so very much for your service. Members, we're adjourned.